Good afternoon. My name is Sharon, and I serve the village's education lead. And it's 4 o'clock, and another session is starting. And we're thrilled that so many of you are here on such a beautiful day. So I'd like to reintroduce Glenn Jordan. And today he is going to talk about imagination in the Bible, but also renewing the city, correct? So thank you very much.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for coming back. That's great. And it's good to see. It's actually very encouraging to see the numbers of people who are willing to step out of a beautiful day like this into a darkened room to hear an Irishman witter on about stuff. What a plan to do today. Again, progressing this notion of developing the muscles of our imagination for reading the text, so that we can then see that text incarnated in our communities, and even dare I say it, in our nation and in our world. And I want to introduce you a little bit to Belfast. There are some people who have been to Belfast. Anybody here? Well, I know you have. But I want to introduce you to a little bit, a small part of Belfast that Chuck and Peg know very well. Say a little bit about its history and background very quickly. And then I'm going to get you to do a little bit of work for 10 or 15 minutes. And we're then going to have a conversation about your work. And then to finish up, I want to tell you how we did the practice of Bible reading, and then incarnating that reading into a very special project in our part of the city. I hope that's of interest to you. I hope that's something along the lines of what you're expecting. But the honest reality is, if it's not, I haven't got anything else. So if I close my eyes, you can leave now. But I'm going to trust you're going to stay around for a while anyway. It was my privilege to work for about 15 years in Inner East Belfast with the Methodist Church. Inner East Belfast is over the river, over the Lagan River in Belfast, and one of the most socially and economically deprived communities in the whole of the UK. The Methodist Church had been on this, it's about, what would you say, Chuck, would be a mile from the city centre? It's probably a mile from City Hall as the crow flies. But the Methodist Church has been on the same site for about 190 years, and it built a church on this site when Belfast was a small but rapidly growing town down across the river, and this was built in the middle of the countryside on a main road between Belfast and another town called Newton Arns, and it was built unusually for a Methodist church with a graveyard behind it, because they saw part of their ministry in those early days, in that village. They saw it as something they could offer as a ministry to give Methodist itinerant preachers a resting place in a rural setting, and which is a bizarre idea when you see what has become of the city, and we'll show you some of the shots in a moment. So it had a missiological intention as a Methodist community right from the beginning. Well, of course, that city was very quickly overtaken by the growth of Belfast City, as Belfast became the engine of the growth that fueled the British Empire. There was a period at the end of the 19th century when the east of Belfast was known for these enormous, great big linen mills. Much of the linen that was used but for army uniforms in the great wars fought by the British Empire used linen made in Belfast. We had, at one stage, at the start of the 20th century, the largest rope works in the world was in Belfast. And some ridiculous number, like 93% or 97% of all the rope and twine used by the Allied armies in the Second World War was made in East Belfast. And of course, it had, at the end of the 19th century into the 20th century, Belfast had two of the three largest shipyards in the world. And of course, we're probably most well known for the building of the Titanic. The Titanic set sail from Belfast down to Southampton before embarking on its voyage. And it's a sick, tired, old joke, which you know, people say, what are you claiming the Titanic as the great symbol of your city? And of course, the Belfast, the hoary old joke in Belfast is, well, it was all right when it left us. And so, yes. And it was a British captain. So, I mean, come on, what do you expect? And so it was this enormous industrial powerhouse up until about the 40s or 50s, until the post-war period. In fact, it was so significant that during the Second World War, Nazi fighters flew over and several times bombing Belfast City during the Blitz in an attempt to destroy the factories that were making ships and making armaments and so on. Thing is, all of that's gone. In a single generation, gone. The shipyards used to employ over 30,000 people, and in the space of one generation, they now employ, last I heard, was 150. In a generation. And around all this heavy industry grew all of these big factories and linen mills were owned by the Protestant ascendancy. And so all the housing and tightly, densely packed housing all around this part of Belfast, overwhelmingly Protestant community, who got jobs in the factories and the shipyard and the ropeworks and the linen mills and so on. It had another effect which still lingers, and that was that because employment was guaranteed for every Protestant boy, employment was guaranteed in one of the big factories. The Protestant community in Belfast never had to think about education. So schooling finished for every Protestant boy effectively at 13, 14. With the result that even today, 25% of men and boys in East Belfast are functionally illiterate. Because we've never developed a value around education. That huge steep decline also coincided with the years of the Troubles. So from the 60s and the 70s and so on, we also had the rise of community tensions and community unrest leading to the IRA's campaign during the 70s and 80s, which eventually ended in the mid-90s with the peace agreement. And the effects of that still rumble on today. But what we are left with is a community that is pretty broken, it has to be said. The shipyard, it's virtually derelict. I mentioned in Vespers on Monday night the mural that you could see from my office in this building, which was this one here. Hooded gunmen of the paramilitary gangs that still hold the community in under some kind of control. Lots of dereliction, lots of empty retail units, and of course the ever-present threat of community unrest and community violence. That's been a fact of life of East Belfast. As I said, the vast majority of people who live there are from the Protestant community, but there is a small Catholic community called the Short Strand, surrounded on three sides by Protestants, hemmed in by what we call the peace lines, which are big high walls that are built to divide, roof high walls that are built to divide Catholics from Protestants. More of those walls have been built since the peace agreement was signed than were built during the years of the conflict. And we have one of them dividing our Protestant Catholic communities. Opposite the doctor's surgery, just down the street from where East Belfast Mission, that's the Methodist Mission, and within the stone's throw of the Short Strand community is a Loyalist Memorial Garden, which commemorates the shooting dead of two Protestant residents and the wounding of 28 others during an IRA action in the 70s. This is right on the street, beside a housing development where people, kids, pass every day. We've got these murals all up and down the street, and part of the kind of subversive artwork that Chuck and Peg and their students brought into the area was to try and reimagine mural work, to give more positive images, to give more aspirational images to kids in the area, get them involved in painting things that didn't involve guns. Meanwhile, in the rest of the city, there was a time in the early 2000s when it looked like the whole of the city was suspended from construction cranes. Everywhere else, building, development, regeneration was going on. And again, there are some people here this week who, several people I've spoken to, who've been to our fabulous new Titanic Memorial Museum, which is one of the great buildings now in Belfast. The actual dry dock from which a lot of the work on the Titanic was done is this here. Is anybody in here prepared to admit they are fans of Game of Thrones? It's filmed in here. The Titanic was designed in this building here. One of the great tourist attractions now in Northern Ireland is the Game of Thrones tour. I've never seen an episode, so I've no idea what it's like. But yes, so building was going on all over the city, and fabulous buildings. And a number of these things impinged on our work in the mission, so I made it my kind of job to get to know the developers of some of these places, to get talking to them. I got to look at their master plan documents, and I was amazed at one thing in particular from these documents. They used extraordinary language. They talked about regeneration. They talked about renewal. They talked about conversion. And they were talking with these transformative words that would be recognizable to any theologically literate individual. Because it was my assertion, all this language is our language, church language. The problem, it seemed to me then in this period, was that somewhere in our history, we had let go of this language and confined these transformative terms purely to the transformation of individuals. And we had let go of the biblical vision of transformation, which was for the whole world, in fact, the cosmos. And here were these private sector developers picking up the language that we had let fall and using it and talking about the transformation of a city. And if you'd have seen a lot of that transformation, Chuck, but you know, I lived there from the 80s to now. It is unrecognizable, the transformation in the city. It's not to say that personal regeneration is not an incredible thing, but it is to say that to confine the regenerative and transformative work of God solely to the individual is to miss out on this cosmic dimension of the gospel. And so we began to read our Bible text again in a new way, beginning to reclaim this language for the church, for people of faith, and ask ourselves, is there power still in this language for the transformation of communities, for the transformation of the world? Can we infuse these words again with theological significance and meaning? Can we set these words on the scale of a city neighborhood, on the scale of a city, on the scale even of a country and beyond? Because that is what the gospel is, I think. And so we began to look at, well, what does our community need? And we talked about it, leaving aside, if you like, the spiritual needs of transformation. We looked at the four things that were going to most obviously affect the lives of our community in a quick and immediate way. Social, physical, environmental and economic renewal. Does the gospel have anything to say to these four terms? And what we discovered is what the Old Testament prophets knew, that to walk down any city street, to move amongst a city's communities, is to be in the realm of God's interest and concern, right down to the streets, not just the people who live on those streets. God is not just concerned with the interior of individuals, but for the spaces those people inhabit. The discovery that God loves the city and all its multitude of spaces and places, and not simply the people of the city, came as an enormous surprise. I'm almost ashamed to say that. But it came as a surprise to us. And the realization that our job as people of faith in the city was not simply to provide citizens for the celestial city, and certainly not to usher in the kingdom by our social action, which are the traps that we often fall into, the different poles of Christian traditions fall into often. But we certainly didn't want to abandon the city so that it become a forbiddingly strange place for people of faith. So, the first inklings of a new approach to this reading came in, I think it was February. I was saying to Tom earlier, yesterday I think, or this morning, I had a bunch of students who regularly came to see what we were doing and learn from what we were doing. We had a bunch of students, theological students, and they were the most demotivated bunch I'd ever met. And it was a damp, wet day, and I couldn't get them out to walk around the street, and I was stuck with them in the building for half a day, and I just couldn't, and I was rapidly losing kind of patience with them. And we were sitting in the room, in the building, which was across the street from our main site, and my office was on the first floor overlooking the site. And over on the other side of the road, directly opposite where we were sitting, was a derelict site. It had been occupied by six single-story flat roof retail units, was bought by a developer. He couldn't do anything with them. He demolished them because it helped for tax purposes. And he didn't know what to do with them. And that was the sight I got when I looked out my window. This guy is Aidan. He worked in our hostel for people who were homeless, so he's cycling on his way to work when I took this photograph. Anyway, what I did, and it was not planned, it was just a fortuitous thing of frustration, and I got them all to move their chairs to the windows. There's three windows along the side of the office. And every 15 of them all brought their chairs. We pulled up the blinds, and by way of looking for a break from them, I set them a task, which I'm actually going to set you in a minute, but not because I'm bored with you in any way, but because to my my eternal delight, the task really did fire them and work them, and I'm hoping that they'll do the same for us today. They were looking out on this site, and I gave them two verses from the prophet Zechariah. This is what the Lord Almighty says. Once again, men and women of ripe old age will sit in the streets of Jerusalem, each with cane in hand because of his age. The city streets will be filled with boys and girls playing there. Tell me that isn't a fantastic couple of verses of scripture. And I was completely unfamiliar with it until just relatively recently before this group came. Anyway, I said to them, we go back. I said to them, I'll give you the verse again in a moment, to look out that window, and I'm going to give you half an hour to work in groups of ones, twos, threes, however big you want to be. And I want you to imagine that the kingdom of God has come inside this Harris fencing. See all this fencing? I want you to imagine that the kingdom of God has come there. Nowhere else, just there. And you are to leave aside all the knowledge you have, the pre-existing knowledge you have, and the only thing you're equipped with are two verses from the prophet Zechariah. These two verses from Zechariah. What does the kingdom of God look like on the city street? And I want us to do that now. And I am banning all language like, you know, everybody will love each other. Okay? Ban that because it's not sufficiently rooted in the ground and on the street. So no pious, you know, airy-fairy language that, you know, has no practical intent. We will take all that for granted. Okay? I want to know what's on that street. Now, there's no right answer to this. So before you embark on this, don't think, oh, I wonder, will I get it right? Will I get it right? There's no right answer. This is, the options here are as multitudinous and as varied as the people in this room. And I'll tell you, I've done this a couple of times and with different groups, and I'll tell you some of the ideas that have come up. And I guarantee you will not have thought of some of the weird things that have been suggested by people in the course of this exercise. So, we've got a nice big room here. There's your two verses. Translate those two Bible verses onto a piece of territory. It happens to be a piece of territory in Belfast, but it could be anywhere. You know, if you want to work in twos, threes, fours, I don't care. If you want to be a sad Norman nomates, you can work by yourself, find a bit of space, do some thinking, creative, imaginative thinking, and bring the kingdom of God to bear on that piece of land. Again,
how much time did you say?
I'm going to give you 10. I'm going to be pretty short because the conversation's going to be better.
Okay.
So 10, 15 minutes, and... said before, act like you understand what I'm instructing you to do, and let's get going. Does anybody in the room recognize the music? It's our other great export from East Belfast. It's Van Morrison. So if you're fans of Van Morrison, he lives in a fine big house in a really, really, in the outskirts of Belfast, but his mom, who died just last year, lived just around the corner from the mission. And the story was, she used to be, we had a day centre for older people, and they were picked up every day and brought in and into our place and looked after and so on. And their bus broke down, and it was going to cost a fortune to repair it, so she just picked up the phone to Van and told him, we need a new van, we need a new bus. And Van just told one of his people to go, and within a week they had a £30,000-£40,000 new bus for his mum's crew. But he's infamously grumpy, and he really is. But anyway, he's so I'm interested, certainly by the sound, assuming you were talking about the set task, the level of conversation seemed to be good, and you should be aware, as I am, that we have Old and New Testament professors in the room, so our translations of the text, we've got to be very careful and on point. But let's hear what come out of your conversations. What do you want to do on this site? How does the kingdom look when it's translated onto the street? Who wants to go first before I conscript?
My first suggestion was to take the fence down.
Why would you do that?
Why would you? Well, we had a little bit of discussion about it, because if you're eventually going to transform it into a place where children are playing, then maybe you would need some kind of a barrier there to keep the children safe.
Sure.
So that eventually could happen, but for right now, the fence, well, obviously keeps people out. So that first, the fence has to go.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
and then the other question, too, are we making an assumption that this is a public piece of property? It's privately owned, right?
Do you know what? Do we really need to get down to the legalities of signing contracts for the kingdom now?
This is America, you know.
Well, that's true, yes. I'll probably get sued for taking over, for squatting on his land. But I dare you to tell God he can't do what he wants to do in that piece of land. Yes, sir.
Can we assume that there are a lot of people living around here?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah, good.
We wanted to make it a community park.
Okay.
With playgrounds and benches and trees and flower gardens. And the most creative idea, I thought, was we had the idea of putting in mailboxes or something like that with picture books in it, and have churches have a mission project of filling that those mailboxes with picture books for the children, and eventually be a lending library with picture books for the whole community.
Brilliant. We'll talk to our lawyers about getting that organized, and then we'll... Yeah, brilliant. Like I said, this is really, we're only limited by our imagination here, so, you know, everything works. Tom, yeah.
Well, we felt like the space was a little small.
Good,
and
yeah.
We need a lot of intergenerational housing. Yes. So we're imagining housing in the kingdom of God to be like Doctor Who's TARDIS.
Brilliant, yes.
With a bunch of TARDISes around the edge, but you will go inside, you've got all this vast room for old people, middle-aged yeah. people, parents, kids, who then spill out of these yeah. housing places into...
So the housing's integrated. Mm-hmm. The housing for... I mean, I don't know what the States is like, but certainly in our place, you know, we zone our cities and we put business here and we put our entertainment districts here and we put our hospitals here and we separate it all out. But here we're talking about at least we're going to place all the generations together. I think, God, how rich is that? Yes.
We thought the kingdom of God comes for everyone. So every... many facets should be represented on a property like that. So we thought of a playground, a senior center, a homeless shelter, a food bank, just all of the things that the people of the world need but don't always receive. So it was a dog park. We have to include the animals.
I absolutely, well, you know, absolutely would be all for that. Dogs will be in heaven. Cats won't, but dogs will.
Yes. But we have to have a garden to grow vegetables.
Okay.
And so we also about need a place well. To cook them and serve them.
Great.
And teach people how to cook them and serve them.
And grow them.
And we felt that the gardens would be a wonderful way for the generations to interact with each other. Mm-hmm. That, you know, the people with the canes would be teaching the young kids how to grow.
Yeah, it strikes me, just standing here right now, it sounds a little bit like Holden, but that's a whole other thing. Well, yeah.
I also wanted to say, when you were talking about the libraries everywhere, you need to have those children sit down with the old people and have
we talked
read
about
to
that.
Each other.
Yeah,
yes.
We talked about that.
Good.
Okay.
Good.
We talked
well,
about
speaking
having
of
hold, hold a second. Sorry,
well, we talked about having Adirondack type chairs, but having them for
we've now got interior designers for the kingdom.
No,
this
I
is great.
Next door to little tiny. I mean, you wouldn't just seat all the big ones together and little ones together. You'd seat them intermittently you would encourage the little person to sit down with the big person.
Great.
Speaking of the Holden influence, we decided that ice cream has to be a has to be part of this park.
I had some ice cream today, and I fully agree. I fully agree. Yeah, good. Yes?
I wondered, too, about how we would gather people together and find out how those in the neighborhood, what would be important to them, what would be significant to them. And also, the place, you know, that slide is really great. There's not a lot of beauty there. And so how would color and beauty be incorporated into that space?
Yeah, how do we make the space beautiful?
Yes.
Absolutely right.
And music. There's certain musical instruments that you just walk around or up and down stairs and you play a song. It would be exercise and...
Perfect. Perfect. You can be our fitness guru then for the...
That we would also want to capture both history of the community
yes.
and
maybe even good. A little bit about the people who used to live in those houses.
Good.
To kind of
yes.
express that connection to the family.
Excellent. We'll come back to that later on. That's a really good. That's really good. Exactly. You know. Sorry, I don't. I'm not going to. This is great. Anything else? What else? You know, how do we envisage the kingdom on the space?
There's a smallish space that probably many people here have been to down in Portland, Oregon, that is filled with nothing but food trucks, and it is amazing how many people, young and old, gather. I always think if you feed them, they will come.
My food. I mean, I think you're right. Who was it said that there would be place to eat and you know for generations to gather to read stories, but to eat and to play. You know, you see things like for me, men and women of ripe old age will sit, each with a cane. The cane suggests, you know, mobility issues. So, you know, there's got to be infrastructure on the street that enables. Men and women of ripe old age to be in the midst of community. That means you're going to have chairs at regular intervals that people can struggle between, and but can sit in the middle. City streets filled with boys and I mean that you know from traffic calming techniques to doing something else with how people get around the streets so that it's safe for play. The fact that. City streets are filled. People, you know, Tom's point there, people living here. So there's a balance between you know, what residential imperatives are versus what are the retail or commercial imperatives. We find some way of balancing these things out. Anything else that we're missing that from your conversation that hasn't... As I said, I'm not simply... I hope want to, you know, ignite your imagination, but also inspire you a little bit in terms of...
We ban cars from this street.
You ban cars. Well, you got... Well, yeah.
So it's a softer, quieter place that encouraged kids to play.
To play there. So it's safe to play there.
So then we need new language. We can't call it a street anymore.
Okay.
Well, we think about the place... There's a place in Stockholm that's just... an area that's you just walk around. There's no, and the streets are on the outside of it.
Uh-huh. In Charleston, South Carolina.
Yeah.
Right.
With those conversations, explorers.
Mm-hmm. Anything else?
Everybody's imagining a park-like setting, and we did too. But you know, we don't want our benches just spread out like this. We want them in conversational situations, so you can talk to your neighbor.
Yeah. Lovely. Yeah. Good.
I'm going to put in a plug for the city streets because I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and we played in the city streets regardless of whether cars were going or not.
Yeah. What's that famous book about New York communities?
A Tree Grows in
Brooklyn. Jane, is it? Sorry?
A Tree Grows in Brooklyn.
No. She's written about, I'll find it before the end of the day. She's written about how to design a community, an urban community, and how to deal with streets.
She's in Belfast. Yeah.
Are you talking about a she or a
he? It's a she.
Okay, it's not
in my gender. No. Leave it with me. It'll come to me. But yeah, you see, I mean, we've got a couple of directions we can take from this point on. One is we could take the direction to say. How many of our churches look like this? What we've just been talking about. I mean, these are our scriptures, these are our texts. How many of these conversations are happening in the context of our churches? But I'm not sure there's a lot to profit us by going that way. But it is, I think, maybe just to suggest... I guess with a text like that, or any countless other texts, particularly in the prophets, we can push these texts way off into the future as a source of hope, in a sense, to say to us, look, I know it's not great there at the minute, but if you hang on, it's going to look like this, and you'll be fine. Or we can drag these texts off the page, and you know, we've got to work at them, we've got to understand them, and then we've got to say, well, could we imagine even a partial realization of some of these things on our city streets today, in our church communities? Have we got a piece of land around our church building at the moment where we could do an imaginative exercise like this with our congregation and say, let's just take this little bit of land and we'll turn it into some of the things we've talked about here. What would that cost us? What are the implications? What are the, you know, we've got a team of lawyers here who'll help you with the legal ramifications of insurances and so on. But you know, is there something down this road that would help us imagine what the kingdom feels like and how the kingdom might be experienced, to give people the foretaste of it now as a way of, yeah, okay, as a way of growing our churches, but as a way of really seeing our churches make a difference in our streets. We decided to take the prophet's words seriously. Not just to encourage us to hang on till things get better. And we began to act as if the new city had already come down out of heaven from God, to see how it would affect. And we started with this piece of land, and that's what emerged on it. So if you're looking across the street, that's the land running through here. It became a community garden, growing lots of food, managed by the local community. Lots of the produce has been used in the community cafe. It's a gathering space. These are children from the day nursery on the site who, they have, it's the cutest thing in the world. They have these lots of little tiny, titchy, multicolored watering cans, and every day a class marches out and they pick up the watering cans and they fire water into the raised beds. The gate into this, because we were talking about how to open it to the street, the gate into the community garden is not on the church side of the property. It's on the public street side. So the gate is up in the corner here. And it, because it is accessible to the local community. That's just what, that, and that came from that conversation with those students. They were very determined. They even got down to talking about different kinds of planting, stuff that would give height and would be, you know, would point to the heavens, stuff that would give shelter, stuff, you know, and color and beauty, and you know, and there was a barbecue pit, you know, and this is the second incarnation of the community garden. The first one was a bit more rustic, but again, it had a community barbecue station. It had, you know, and it is still, you know, a place of gathering. So we began to ask all sorts of questions, and it became, I think my conclusion out of it was that not just in our churches, but in our communities, imagination is as much a deprivation in communities and in churches as all the other deprivations that affect our communities of income and education and so on. The deprivation of imagination is expressed in hostility towards change and new development, in the low numbers participating in community consultations on change, and just in reducing the capacity of people to imagine how this could be different. You know, the community lacked the resources to imagine how things could be other than what they were, and so it became about managed decline, much as our churches have existed for many, many years, in processes of managed decline, because we can't imagine how it could be any different. Or we can't imagine outside of the traditional ways of encountering our communities, which is a phrase in itself. And so we need new feats of imagination fueled by our Bible text to enable us to find ways out and to learn the vocabulary of change and transformation and regeneration and newness. I started reading the prophet Isaiah, and in particular, the last section of the prophet Isaiah, which, roughly speaking, you know, from chapter 56, scholars generally take to be after the exile, when people were making their way back to Jerusalem. And it wasn't as, you know, they imagined in 2nd Isaiah when, you know, they were saying, oh, the roads are going to be straight and the trees are going to be singing as you return to the glorious holy city. And they struggle to get back there. They dwindle back in small numbers at first, and they get back and Jerusalem is a mess. Not only is it a mess, but all these factions are fighting over how to do it. We're going to build the temple first. We're going to get the worship system set up first. No, I think you should get rid of all the foreigners and purify the people so that we're just God's people. And you know, and the Isaiah followers are coming back and saying, actually, there's probably another way of doing this. And they're coming back to this city that is really in need of regeneration. And what we thought to do then was to, could we read the book, these last chapters of Isaiah through the lens of our particular circumstance in East Belfast? Could we read it through those contemporary urban circumstances and try to explore the surplus of meaning in the text that would help us change our city streets, much as the followers of Isaiah were trying to change the streets of Jerusalem in their time? And that's where we began. Here is that site with the shop units still on it before they were demolished. This is the old church building. And beside us was a big warehouse. And we created this new building, which I'll say a little bit more about now. But it seems to me that is one of the tasks of people of faith, to equip traumatized communities with the imaginative resources needed both to articulate the shape of the newness they need and then to realize it or its approximation. That, to me, is the task of the church in our communities, to equip people to articulate the change that is needed to make our communities livable spaces again, spaces that more accurately or more fully reflect the kingdom, if you like to put it that way. So we began to work and transform and change. And it was our intention then that the fruit of our reflection, to take the consideration of the text and feed it into our design with our architects. Our architects were not, if you like, a Christian architect firm. They were just a regular bunch of architects. Funnily enough, the architectural firm that won the contract to design it was a very small. We had all the big, because this was a big project, this was a multi-million pound project. All the big architectural firms wanted in on this. But this small firm of Catholic architects, and you can only say that in Northern Ireland, but Catholic architects won the contract and designed this iconic building in the heart of Protestant East Belfast. So that they got something of the symbolism issue we were thinking. So we said, right, listen, we're reading Isaiah and we want to design a building with the help of this text. And I'm sure they went in privately and thought, nutters, we're dealing with nutters here. but they bought into it in an incredible way. And that act of daring began to take shape over a period. As we began to think about 3rd Isaiah's description of Jerusalem in the aftermath of exile and our contemporary circumstances in the aftermath of conflict, sitting those two contexts side by side, suffering multiple forms of deprivation, the trauma of conflict. And Isaiah feeds into our situation with some astounding words: "Be glad and rejoice forever. in what I will create, for I will create Jerusalem to be a delight and its people a joy. I will rejoice over Jerusalem and take delight in my people. Now imagine your own setting. Imagine your own community setting or city setting, or even on a national scale. And insert that name, whatever that community's name is or your country's name, insert it into the space that currently reads Jerusalem. For us, it was, be glad and rejoice forever in what I will create, for I will create inner East Belfast to be a delight. Oh, I mean, what a challenge. Our reputation was in the gutter as a community, as the most sectarian community in Belfast. And we set ourselves the target of saying, would we dare to believe that inner East Belfast would be a delight to the city, to the people of the city? Whenever you think, whenever somebody mentions inner East Belfast, they'll think, oh, yes, what a lovely place. Instead of, tourists never come to inner East Belfast unless they're accompanied. I will create your space to be a delight and its people a joy. Imagine a transformation so complete, so total, that your community and your people are an unending source of joy and pride and delight for the rest of your city. And now think what's required for that to happen. What actions taken today could begin to move your community towards that place? What do we need to do? We began to look at social renewal. Never again will there be in it an infant, and for it again, slot in your community, slot in your nation. Never again will there be in the United States an infant who lives but a few days, or an old man who does not live out his years. The one who dies at 100 will be thought a mere child. The one who fails to reach 100 will be considered accursed. This place will be characterized as a place that pays attention to the lives of its most vulnerable citizens, its infants and its older people. It's a city in which every individual, or a place in which every individual, gets to participate fully in all the joy that the city has to offer. You're not excluded from any place or any opportunity. Infants will grow to maturity and live out a full measure of days in this delightful place. And it's a place of joy and delight precisely because in this newness that Yahweh will bring, the conditions are such to enable children to grow up in security and safety. The people of the city are valued not because of their productivity, because even older people, way past their economic usefulness, are considered blessed long into their old age. Indeed, the weight of years is considered a blessing and not a burden to us. There are no unfinished stories in this place. All infants will grow into the fullness of their lives and have their own place in the unfolding history of this place. No lives will end prematurely, but each one will reach fulfillment after a rich and long span of years. Now, in any community, historical or contemporary, this does not happen without intention. This aspiration must be supported by an infrastructure that enables these things to happen. Health and social care and so on, to bring every individual to their full potential and to ensure that no one falls through the cracks in service which are created by inequalities of provision or access. So when you consider your own debate here about healthcare, and we reduce this just to an economic battle, no side's going to win that. And certainly not the people who need it. But how do we articulate a vision? How do we articulate care for our vulnerable citizens in a way that is compelling? Can we bring our imaginative resources to bear on our biblical text? Can we begin to produce micro examples of how we care for people that in the course of time, by the work of the Spirit, will work their way out wider? So we have a vision of social renewal. Physical renewal. I'm going to rattle through this so that we get time to talk again. Look at this from Isaiah 58. Your people will rebuild the ancient ruins and will raise up the age-old foundations. You will be called repairer of broken walls, restorer of streets with dwellings. Isaiah 58 is a fantastic chapter. And it begins with the people of God. It is so contemporary. It begins with the people of God, with God saying to this, listen, tell these people their sin. Because it's sickening me. They're complaining all the time. We have our worship conferences and, you know, you don't seem to turn up. We go to church, we read our Bibles, we're involved in all the right-on activities, but God, you always seem to act, where are you? And it's a complaint of people about the absence of God. And God says, look, he challenges them. He said, look, you want me to turn up? Then he says, loose the chains of injustice. Untie the cords of the yoke. Set the oppressed free. Break every yoke. Is it not my will that you share your food with the hungry and provide the poor wanderer with shelter? When you see the naked, clothe them. And all the opposite. This is the really fascinating one for me, which is the last one. Says, this is the mark I'm looking for. It's that to ensure that you don't turn your back on your own flesh and blood. That's what the Bible says. Now, who your flesh and blood are, we could talk about your family. We could also talk about your neighbor. And one of the marks of an authentic community of God's people is that we don't turn our back on our own flesh and blood. And if you do all these things, then your light will break forth like the dawn. That's how you make your mark in your community. Your healing will then appear. Your righteousness will go before you. The glory of the Lord will be your rear guard. Then you will call and God will answer. I will answer. But this, and it goes on, but this startling vision of social renewal, the people of God, ends in a fascinating place for me who is interested in the built environment. And he says, you will be completely intolerant of dereliction in your communities. In fact, you will become known as the people who repair broken walls, who build up streets with dwellings. Now, we have a million and one names that we use to describe the church. I've yet to hear us described as the repairers of broken walls and the rebuilders of streets with dwellings. But it is one of the marks of the church, if you like, as the people of God, as they engage in the life of their communities, that they become known as the people intolerant of dereliction, committed to restoring their communities by building in their communities, not just churches. And it's this maintenance of the connection between physical form and social concern that ensures the ongoing success of the city. The extent to which the social vision and the city form are joined together is the extent to which, as the text says, the waters which nourish the society can be, and the community can be described as unfailing. Merge these two, social concern and physical form in your city, and the waters that nourish your community will be unfailing. That's what the Bible says, it seems to me. very, very briefly, and I'm sorry we don't have a lot more time to look in these. The wolf and lamb will feed together, and the lion will eat straw like the ox, and dust will be the serpent's food. They will neither harm nor destroy in all my holy mountain. The vision for social renewal, the vision for physical renewal, there is an impact then on the rest of the created order. There is an impact on the environment of our of living sustainably in this new city, taking steps to live and change this new city. Economic stability returns. We're looking just quickly in a moment. The abiding presence of Yahweh with them always. But the repair of the damage that has been done is never limited just to the damage caused to the human population. Not just the human dimension of creation, but the restoration affects the whole of the creation. Isaiah dares to believe that the improved fortunes of human Israel will be reflected in the rest of the created order as well. Even the animal creation, he says here, will enjoy the same peace, security, and abundance as the human creation. And economic renewal. This is probably a more difficult one in the context of the US, but in an Irish situation where so many of our population have been forced to emigrate because of poor economic circumstances, the vision here of people returning and bringing with them the fortune they have made where they have been exiled, bringing back their fortunes for the rebuilding of their place, has, I think, particular resonance in an Irish context. So all of these things are working together. There is this economic concern, the transformation of the economic circumstances caused by the returning of those previously exiled. Some of them have chosen this exile. Some have had it forced upon them. And the sons come from afar. Daughters are carried on the hip, bringing their gold and their silver. Always, 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 the direction of travel in the past has been out and away. And something happens in this work of transformation, in this community as it changes, that the direction is reversed and people start coming back. I have been involved in countless conversations here in the last couple of days, and I am amazed at the number of places y'all have lived, and how very few of you are still living in the places that where you were born and brought up, where your roots are. So you travel to family and reunions and so on. And I don't know if it's in any way significant here, but I wonder if this is something that we transform our communities so that, you know, home and place becomes important to us again. That we can't just live anywhere. We can't just take our skills and take them anywhere. But actually, we learn the value of putting down roots. I recently was thinking about the Wendell Berry book, Jaber Crow. And Jaber, the barber of the town, had once upon a time thought he wanted to make his fortune. He thought he could pack his whole life up into a box and leave the town because it was too small for him. And he leaves to become a minister, and he's forced back to be a pastor, and he's forced back. And instead of becoming a pastor, he becomes the barber. Maybe there's a parable there, but in terms of our usefulness to our communities. But he learns the value over that time of rootedness in the place. This, and there's a powerful chapter in which he first returns, and then he goes and visits all the places, ending up in the graveyard. where his parents and his grandparents and his great-grandparents are buried. And he sits down by the gravestone and he knows all the names in this place. And he stays so long in this place that there's one part where he talks about cutting hair of different generations of families. And he could almost blindfold tell what family you were from just by placing his hands on your skull. Place his hands on the head and he knew you were part of that family. Sometimes the name was that name, but he knew you were descended from there because of the shape of your head. And Barry is one of the great prophets of that rootedness. And here, this is a very moving image for Irish people. My mom and dad would want nothing more than to see my brother who lives in Redmond coming back home. But he never will. But this is about the repatriation of wealth. Let me rush on here. Communities, I think, all of our communities, no matter where we are, urban, rural, suburban, we need prophets. We need a resurrection of imagination, and central to this resurrection is the role of the prophet who senses opportunity where no one else can see it. But it's not just seeing opportunity. It's also the capacity to speak that opportunity into being. To speak that opportunity in ways that are simultaneously compelling and fresh. And to come back to your point earlier, sir, in deep continuity with what has gone before. The speaker of the words, the stirrer of imagination, lives simultaneously in the past and in the future in order to speak with intent into the present. And it's in the act of speaking these words, as we did a few moments ago, we spoke words of transformation into the air. We dared to utter what is not but what could be. That's what stirs new life in lethargic hearers. Prophets are careful listeners who listen to the text, but also to the context in which they are placed, to the past and its present. And it is in their capacity to bring both our text and our context together that opens the future for communities, if we learn to read this thing with imagination. So we need the careful listeners, careful readers of text and interpreters of history, so that our communities will have the imaginative capacity. One writer said, words create worlds. Human systems move in the direction of what they most talk about. Questions are fateful. Change begins with the first question we ask. Communities are in need of renewal, and nations in need of renewal need those who will ask the fateful questions of why things are as they are and why they are not the way they should be. Framing the right questions about our circumstances is critical because the questions will set the direction of travel. Finding the courage to speak about the future and ways out of an undesirable presence helps create the propulsive power and necessary to kind of break the gravitational bonds of previous failures that hold us rooted to the earth, but helps set a trajectory for change into the future. And we found that propulsive power in the text of Isaiah. And we wanted to make it beautiful. And so we hired artists like Chuck and Peg and others. And I want to show you just some of the examples. These are the doors into the sanctuary. This is the door's made of oak. And these black random pieces are actually Irish bog oak. These are oak trees that fell into the bog maybe thousands of years ago, 2,000 years ago. In the airless environment of the bog, the wood undergoes a chemical transformation, comes out black and really, really hard. We employed a craft worker who worked with bog oak, and we asked him, we talked long and hard about the doors into our sanctuary. And so we set these pieces of ancient bog oak into the contemporary oak of the doors. We drew an arbitrary line across the top, and we called that line 1826, which was the year that the first church was built on that site. And then we measured a centimetre for every year until the second church was built, until the third, and this was 2012. So that the congregation coming for worship today will be constantly visually reminded that there have been others here before. So we set the historical church into the context of the contemporary, the historical oak into the context of the contemporary oak, as a reminder that we stand on shoulders, but as a reminder that someday there may be another line drawn here which will be us. What are we handing on? What history? The angle of the doors here are unusual. And these angles, you won't see a photograph, but the angle is also the same as the angle on the lectern, the legs of the lectern, and the legs of the communion table. And this angle is a representation of the angle of the legs on the Harland and Wolff cranes in the shipyard. And we kept these windows, this is the inside of the sanctuary, we kept the windows here clear, and then clear in the front doors into the gathering space, so that you could see from the pulpit all the way into the shipyard. We reckon we're the only church in the city that you can see out into public and see the shipyard. Even though the cranes are visible from everywhere in the city, we reckon it's the only pulpit from which you can see the cranes. As a reminder, not just of our history of faith, but as of our industrial history as well. I've got a couple of examples, but I'd rather leave us a bit of time. I want to tell you a little bit about these panels. These are 5 meters high, and they are part of the rain screening of the building. And we reckon it's... Each one of these are 5 meters high, aluminium, glass bonded onto aluminium. And we reckon this is the largest public art installation in the city, because every one of these has been hand-painted by a local artist. Asked him, when we were talking about what we wanted the front of our building to look like, I said to him, imagine we covered the front of our building with mirrors to mirror the sky, so that the front of our building was a constantly changing mirror of a constantly changing East Belfast sky. And so Johnny McEwen, who's a local artist, came in, and we didn't even know this could be done. We said, can you paint these? Because normally you just put the stuff on. Can you paint them? We asked the manufacturer, and he said, no idea, but come over and experiment. So Johnny spent a week or two in the factory. It's fascinating. These are made with powdered glass. And when you powder glass, if it's red glass and you powder it, it's white. If it's blue glass and you powder it, it's white. It's always white. So Johnny had these jars in front of him, and I've got photographs, probably have photographs on that, of these, all these jars of different coloured glass, but all in the form of white powder. And Johnny would mix the white powder with a bonding agent, put it in a spray gun, and spray blue onto this big panel lying on the ground. And then he would get another colour, he put it in, and he would spray that. And before it all dried, he gets his brush and he works these sky and cloud images into the thing. Thing is, when he's finished this panel and all the painting's done, it's just a mass of white and grey. Then the panel is taken, it's hung on hooks, and it moves slowly through a kiln, and it's fired in the kiln. Okay? This is our building is a sermon. It's fired in the kiln. The glass powder then bonds again and recovers its original color and comes out at the other end like these. You see, the beauty that emerged, nobody knew, nobody saw, but it was in the artist's head. He knew what he was working on, but it had to go through the fire first so that everybody else could see. And so we hung 42, I think, of these panels across the front, every one of them hand-painted. And in the architect's mind, he described these two layers of panels on the two floors. He imagined them as two people in the community walking together, so that the front of our building is the past of this community. Two people walked through time in this community. There were fat years and there were lean years. There were years of trauma. These are the representations of the shipyard cranes in the skyline. But they also stand for the years of trauma and violence that the community has. But they walk together through it. And then the photo I showed you originally, then this turns into this square. And this square is today in the community. This is Skeena Square. This is the circulate. This is the living space. This is the, you know, you come to church here, the cafe's here. I told you about our day nurse, our day center for older people. It's along here. We built it along here with windows overlooking the square so that older people would come into our day center and could see the whole life of their community moving in and through this square. This is present. This is today. This is the living, changing, growing community of today. We've come from the past into the present. And then by the time you hit our community garden, you are now looking at the future. The growing, changing, refreshing, new future down the street. So the whole history of our community is written in the front of our building. And we tell those stories to our community. Our green wall is the feature at the very end of our square. Just as you turn the corner down to the community garden, we've got currently what is the only vertical garden in Ireland, I think, certainly the only one that has survived. It's constantly growing and changing and developing and renewing itself. And so the history of our community is built into the walls. And one last, I'll tell you these lastly. For environmental, as part of the environmental dimension of our building, we've a lot of poured concrete, which has helped with the kind of air conditioning of the building. One of the functions of, some of you will know how this thing, you know, the contractors build these big timber shutters and they pour the cement into it. And they've got these big long bars holding it all together. And when they take them away, they leave these holes in the concrete. Sometimes, most often, those holes are just covered over. And sitting with the architect one day, we thought, can we do something with this? Can we do something different with these holes? So we got a craft worker, and we said, could you make, with ceramics, could you make representations of bolts and screw heads? And she had a look and she experimented and she produced these beautiful, and using four different colors, these lovely ceramic bowls. They're about so big. And in some of them, we've got the year that the building was opened, 2012. Some of them have just got Skenos etched into them. Some of them have the other years that churches were built, 1952, 1826, 1919. And then we got Heather to wander around the building. Like, there are hundreds of these holes, hundreds of them. And every one of them has got one of these bolts attached. And she randomly scattered them all. So some of them are just blank with maybe a cross in them, like for a what do you call, you have a different word for that kind of a cross?
Phillips.
You could, that's right. Or shaped like a big bolt. Some of them, as I said, of the 12, but she's randomly scattered them all around the building. And sometimes in stairwells that are never ever used, we've got dozens of these things because no corner was left untouched. No corner was without some artwork. And the idea being that we thought we could use our building as a discipleship tool. So, for instance, with our children, we could send them around the building and find 1872, and the kids can run up and down the stairs or, you know, round the foyer and so on, find one or two of the bolts that have 1875, I think it was, or the 2012, and come back and we'll tell you about the congregation that built a new church in 1875, because they built a church with a school attached because of the growing number of children in the village not getting education, so the congregation decided we're going to educate them. Or 1952, the previous church was bombed during the Belfast Blitz in the Second World War, and the congregation stayed through that with no home and then rebuilt in 1952 on the exact model of the building that had been built in 1919. And we'll talk about how we have served this community in different eras and how we've adjusted our physical space to meet and take account of that. So the building itself, but the other dimension of it was, the reason we hit on the screws and bolts is that it's a big building, Chuck, right? It's a big building. It cost probably $35 million, ultimately. The temptation of all that is, and it is a beautiful building, and I'm immensely proud of it, but the temptation is that, you know, we did this. This is our building. Careful, don't touch that. Don't break that, you know. And so to subvert that from the beginning, in these great big, you know, poured concrete wells for the lift shaft, we tried to create the impression that this great big edifice is held together by these delicate handmade bolts. So on this side of the wall, on this side of the lift shaft, you'll have this, and on the other side of the lift shaft, you'll have another one on this side, and we want you to imagine that it runs right through the building, and these handmade, colourful, individual screws and bolts are what hold this building together. Just like the colourful, handmade, diverse people who worship here, who live here, who meet here, who do whatever in this place. This is what holds it together. Not the size of our achievement in making it happen. And if it doesn't serve these colourful individuals, then it doesn't do its job. Walter Brueggemann, a great teacher and professor of the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scripture, said, "The vocation of the prophet is to keep alive the ministry of imagination, to bring people to engage the promise of newness that is at work in our history with God." And here it is. What a commission it is to speak a future that none think imaginable. What a commission it is to speak a future that none think imaginable. yet, is what I would argue, I would add. That was longer than I was anticipating, but that sometimes happens. My apologies. If you've got to leave, please do. If you've got questions that you want to pursue, I'm going to hang around and we'll happily chat about it. Any comments or questions? Or you're eager for dinner.
Have you had other owners of buildings or properties, now that you've created this, that have complemented what you've done?
Yes, what we always imagined that if we could transform this block, that it was of enough of a scale to get change in the two blocks on either side and three on the other side. And if we could create that, if we could regenerate that kind of node on the street, that there are some other things happening by communities, organizations in other parts, that the private sector would be able to stitch the gaps together. But our intention was to catalyze at least in that little spot. And that has happened. I don't think there's a derelict building on either side or on the three blocks opposite. They're all filled. And that wasn't the case previously.
To what extent did you engage the neighborhood in conversation before?
Oh. That's a great story.
Exhaustively. Oh, yes.
I love that. That's one of my favorite stories.
Is this, there was, I got a phone call.
Yeah,
it was difficult. I had, we did it all the time. We were talking all the time and we purposefully kept an open office. You know, the door was always open and people knew that. I got a phone call one afternoon from the kind of, I call him kindly, a ringleader in the street behind us. We were building a hostel for people who were homeless towards the rear of the site. And then there was a social housing unit being built on the filling in a gap in the street behind, and it was looking into our space. So then the residents in this cul-de-sac were very worried about us bringing undesirables in, and I got a phone call from him saying, we've had a bit of a think about some of the things you said and like to chat to you a little bit more. There's a couple of us in my house, I'll be around right now. So I just walked out and around and into his street. And when I got into his house, the whole neighborhood was there, like in his kitchen, which was only about 10, 15 people. But it was a small kitchen. And they had a table, a dining table, small dining table. And he'd taken all the chairs out except one. And the chair was up against the wall. And he said, "There's your seat." And he pushed the table up against me. So that I was sitting behind a table and chair, and the community was in front. And I think it was about 2.5 hours. They just ranted and raved about what we're doing. So we came to an agreement with them. And, you know, we came to what is a very workable and happy compromise about how access and so on. And it worked. After we built the place, had been open about 6 or 8 months, and I was walking out the square and I saw this same guy coming out the stairs from the apartment at the top. And, you know, and you had to be a key holder to get in through the door to get to the stairs to get up to the apartments on the top. And so I went over to him and I said, "Well, what are you doing here? How did you get in there?" And he said, "My daughter was looking for a house, and because we had some social housing up on the top and some private apartments, and fabulous views over the city." And he said, "And so I'm helping her move in." So his daughter was moving in, and I said, "After all the grief you gave me about how this building was never going to work, you're now moving your daughter in?" He said, "I'll tell you something else." He said, "Her apartment's gorgeous, and I've got onto the housing association and I'm getting the one next door. And he moved in. He was a social housing tenant in the other house, and he gave that contract, I think, to another family member, and he moved into one of the Skenos apartments. So that now he and his daughter were up on the top deck, and I think another daughter was now in his old house. So his family was back together. But the cheek of him, that was my attitude. And but it showed, it just was a kind of an evidence to us that, flip, I think this might have worked. But we did endlessly talking with the community and adjusting plans. I mean, we had four different iterations of the plans based on consultations and consultations with the congregation as well for years, years.
Where did all the money come from?
I could tell you, but no, it took a long time to raise the money. The congregation put in about £30,000 because it's an inner city congregation. That was a big stretch. The rest we raised, and the government, because the community was designated as a community of special social and economic need, the government had money to spend in it, but nowhere to spend it. So we went and it took about 3 years, but we persuaded them to put money into this. The European Union, after the peace agreement was signed, the European Union put millions in to stabilizing the place and underpinning peace. And so again, we took several years to persuade them that story. I mean, there's a million stories out of it, but I got a phone call one night from a guy who was second in command of a government department in Belfast, and he said, I need to talk to you about Skenos. I said, not a problem, John. You know, let me know, I'm free next week. And such as, no, I need to talk to you sooner. And I said, well, when? He said, could you get down here, you know, in the next half an hour? So he was about 2 miles away in the city centre, and I went down to him, and I remember it because his office was on the top of this big, big high building, and he had this fabulous view over the east of the city, and the sun was setting, and it was a lovely evening. And we had made an application to the EU and for funding, and he said to me, what happens if you don't get that money from Europe? I said, I don't know. I haven't thought of option B. And I said, why are you encouraging me to develop one? And he said, you're not getting the money because the government, we have designated a number of projects that we want that European money to go to, and you're not one of them. So you need an option B, and maybe make it smaller, maybe make it less expensive. And I said, no, well, we don't have an option B. We need that money. And it's a remarkable story. Then the Queen's representatives got in touch and said, we'd like to come and visit the mission. And we said, well, we'd love you to come and visit the mission, but we'd prefer you came and visited the community. Can we bring the community into this visit? And anyway, Heal of the Hunted was an amazing occasion when all order broke down, and the Queen was an absolute, she was a marvel. And sometimes I'll tell you the story of all the inappropriate things that Prince Philip said in the course of the visit as well. But we also engineered to get to that meeting, that visit by the Queen, those who are in the line for getting funding, giving us funding, I should say, including the guy who was in charge of the EU body. Now, when the Queen comes to visit, only certain people get to meet her and shake her hand. And you organise them into these little horseshoes, and she knows who she's meeting. And everybody else, we got to stand around the edge of this big hall. But as soon as she stepped in, everybody jumped into the middle. And the Queen was, I think she shook hands with over 250 people that day. And even though these funders who were all standing together, potential funders, weren't meant to meet her, because the order broke down, my colleague, who'll be here next week actually, who was the pastor of the church, he brilliantly said, "Oh, well, come here, Your Majesty, and I'll introduce you to..." So this is... and she had done all her work. She had done... So when Gary introduced this particular guy, the Queen said, "Oh, you're considering giving money to this project, aren't you? I hope you'll find your way to make that happen." Moved on. And I was standing right behind them with her personal aide called Sir Christopher something. And Sir Christopher leaned over to me and he said, "You'll get your money now." I got a phone... She left... And 2 hours later, I got a phone call from that, this time not from that official, but from the government minister of that department saying, "Can I come out next week and launch your project?" And I met John about 2 years later at a Bruce Springsteen concert in Belfast. And he'd had a few drinks and we were walking out after the gig and we were chatting about the thing. And he turned to me then and he said, I won't use his choice of language, but he said, "How the did you get that money? Because you weren't on the list." And I said, "John, we serve a higher master than even your paymasters. And miracles have happened in this project, and getting that money was just one of them." I mean, we talked, to those who were here, as we talked about manna and this notion that there's always enough. And that we found enough somewhere, plucking it out of the air at times. And then there were these incredible, miraculous events that just unlocked doors. That there's a psalm which talks, I think it's Psalm 107, which talks about these sailors cast loose in a storm at sea. And, you know, it says they rose up onto the mountains and then they fell to the valley floor and... they gave up all hope. And it says something like, they came to the end of their skills. And then God intervenes. And I had some incredibly skilled colleagues. And many, many times we came to the end of our skills. And then something happened to unlock it again. And we moved ahead. And, you know, that's just the way. It was not... we did all we could and all we should, but at the end of the day, this building should not have been built in this particular way. With, you know, we shouldn't have been able to employ artists. We shouldn't have been able to make, to put the best materials in this part of the city. But miracles happened, and the word was incarnated onto that space. But it began literally in that room. It began in that room. Thinking, well, if we took the word seriously and we began to imagine that the prophet was serious about what he was saying, that it could happen. And we started to speak it and tell it, and people caught the vision and people were persuaded, and it happened. Folks, you're going to miss dinner.
Thank you so much.
Pleasure. Thank you for listening.